But I think that's actually reflects how a lot of things we do in life are a lot of the time. You know, when we're scared when we, I don't know, start a new business or something. But what's the worst that'll happen? It fails, you look like an idiot, you run out of cash for a bit, and then you'll either get another job, or the worst case scenario, the government will give you some money and some food. We're not dying at the things that we're doing in life. And we tend often to be so afraid of committing to trying stuff. Whereas through force of circumstance, those guys trying to sell hats, I mean, geez, they are properly living adventurously. I'm sure they didn't want to be, but you know, that's, I think it's an important thing to bear in mind that most of the things that people like me do are just playing games and pretending. And therefore we should have the confidence just to throw ourselves into it as fully as we dare.
That's Alistair Humphreys, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome back, or welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is a show all about understanding and embracing uncertainty. And we do this mostly by learning from some of the most fascinating people on this planet. Before we get into our latest episode, I want you to ask yourself what your approach is to decision making. When you have a big decision to make, what do you do? Are you measured, or do you procrastinate, or are you one of those impulsive types of people? I think we all struggle with this at times because, let's face it, we're never really taught decision making. And that's why we are in the process of pulling together our first course, How to Make Impossible Decisions with Calm and Confidence. And you can take our free mini course, which is basically a module of our full course, How to Set Up Any Decision for Success, by clicking on the link in the show notes. Or you can go to all-things-risk.teachable.com, check it out, and also please share the link with anyone who you know is considering a major decision at the moment. All right, let's get into it. Today, I am honored to bring you my conversation with Alistair Humphreys. Alistair, if you don't know who he is an adventurer, an author, and a keynote speaker. He's done things like cycle across the world, walk across India, row the Atlantic Ocean. He was also named National Geographic's Adventure of the Year in 2012 for his work on micro-adventures. And micro-adventures are small adventures designed to get us outside of our comfort zones. And Alistair joined me to talk about his most recent adventure, and we'll get into that in a moment. And this is where I want you to start thinking about your own life, your own routines. In many ways, routines, well, they're good because they help us get on with life, but in other ways, they can be harmful. They can prevent us from learning and growing, and we all have thought patterns that are a little bit like routines. Psychologists call this thing the default mode network. And it's important to find ways to disrupt these patterns from time to time. And that's what Alistair is all about. So, what does someone who has cycled the world, or walked 1,000 miles across the empty quarter, or completed the Marathon des Sables do for a major adventure? Well, isn't it obvious? He, with very little musical training, learns to play some very basic songs on the violin and sets out to spend a month walking across Spain from Vigo to Madrid with no money, eating only from the money he earns playing the violin in village squares, in busking. What? Talk about uncertainty and heading into the unknown. And Alistair wrote a book all about that. His latest book, My Midsummer Morning, is out now. And it is a wonderful book, by the way. And this is an adventure in which Alistair follows the footsteps of another Englishman, someone by the name of Laurie Lee, who in 1935 completed this same journey and wrote a book about it, As I Walked Out one summer morning. It's one of Alistair's favorite travel books of all time, and he's dreamt of retracing Laurie Lee's footsteps for a long time. And we talk about all of that and much more in what I think is just a fabulous conversation. I'm delighted to bring this to you, ladies and gentlemen. Here is Alistair Humphreys. Enjoy. Al, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your midsummer morning, I'd love to, for my listeners, get you to just explain or give a little bit of background to who you are. And it's a terrible question, and which is, what is it that you do when you get asked that question? But how I'm curious how someone like you answers it.
The question, what do you do? I answer in very different ways depending what I'm trying to get out of the answer. So if I was trying to show off, like I'm on a podcast, for example, I would say that I'm an adventurer and an author. I spent 4 years cycling around the world and then spent about a decade or so doing big adventures like rowing across the Atlantic Ocean, walking across India, crossing the Empty Quarter Desert, and writing books about things. If in my head, what I dream to be able to say to people is that I am a writer, but even though I've written 11 books now, that still feels like a fraudulent answer, probably because I don't make my living out of writing. And then if I get onto an aeroplane to fly for 10 hours and the person next door to me asks me what I do, then I tell them I'm a science teacher, which is a total lie, but makes for a brief conversation.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is what my life was going to be before I decided to go and start doing adventures. So it's not a total lie. I did train to be a science teacher.
Yeah, you did. And you talk about that in your book and elsewhere. Could you give a little bit of a synopsis as to how you got into adventuring?
Yeah, I had a very normal upbringing. I grew up in the countryside in the north of England, but it was a very normal rural childhood. It was only really when I finished school at 18, before I went to uni, I spent a year in South Africa, in rural South Africa, teaching in a little school in the middle of nowhere. And that completely opened my eyes to the thrilling excitement of the world beyond the horizons of rural northern England. So that got me hooked on travel. Then at university, I started to get really interested in physical stuff. I joined the reserve army, the weekend army, and spent my weekends running up hills and realized that I was quite good at and quite enjoyed being miserable and suffering. So I decided then to try and combine the two, a curiosity of traveling the world with doing it in a physically challenging way. And that's what led me into the world of traveling by bicycle. So then when I finished university, I decided before I got a proper job and settled down to become Mr. Humphreys, the science teacher, I would first of all go and try and cycle around the world, then settle down to real life. But I think actually cycling around the world was like opening Pandora's box for me. Once I'd opened the box and seen the possibilities of all these adventures, I haven't managed to go back yet.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story, a wonderful background. It's not the normal kind of path for folks, but in some ways, in reading your book, it does seem a little bit like we're all on that kind of journey of adventure, right? That we all yearn for exploring the unknown and this type of thing. And I'm wondering if you could just maybe share a little bit of your thoughts on tackling the unknown and what's so appealing about that to you.
First of all, I don't think that most people are yearning for the unknown and on the path of the unknown. Okay. I suspect everyone who's listening to this podcast is, and everyone who reads any of my books or even has ever heard of me or anyone doing adventure stuff. But I do think that I think that the majority of the world is quite happily just muddling along. Sorry, that's the negative word. I think most of the world is just happily going about their life, with no curiosity whatsoever. And at times I'm incredibly jealous of those people, because I when I'm feeling extremely restless, I'm often very, very envious of those. However, having said that, for the purpose of this exercise, I agree that everyone listening to this will be along those lines. And I can't even remember what your question was now. Sorry.
I guess it was a very open-ended, open-ended, slightly random question. But what is it about the unknown that's appealing?
Oh, yes, the unknown. Well, it's I think it's the same curiosity that leads to a two-year-old trying to poke their fingers into plug sockets or shove their head down the toilet. It's just like, wow, I wonder what that's like. I wonder what that's like. And little, you know, anyone who's ever had the torturous experience of being in a car with a three-year-old will learn that they can say why to a lot of things. Why? And I think that is a wonderful curiosity which the most extraordinary of adults retain. Someone like, say, Einstein, Stephen Hawking, I think they essentially spend their whole life just saying, why? Whereas a lot of us, it just gets drummed out of us at some point of when we are mostly through boring old school, which seems to just beat curiosity out of us and encourage us just to learn all these facts and go write them down. But I think what I've been trying to do as an adult is to go back to some of that youthful curiosity and just try to start asking why more often. And I think the reason I do that is it's just a heck of a lot more interesting than not asking those questions.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, a great way to live. But one that we have to cultivate, right? That's not, as adults, you're right, we get it beaten out of us in various forms.
Yes, I'm sure. I imagine some people probably don't have to cultivate it, but certainly I, in my life, have anything I do now as a adult based on curiosity and adventure and risk is 100%. Deliberately cultivated. My natural inclination and genetics and upbringing are very much to just trundle along with the status quo and be quite lazy and shy and pessimistic. And I realized that was not the way I wanted to be. So everything that I've done away from that has been a conscious effort to build new habits and ways of looking at the world.
Yeah. Okay. That leads us nicely on to my Midsummer Morning, or your Midsummer Morning, and Laurie Lee, and the origins of this wonderful book that you've just written. It would be great if you could explain a little bit of that to my audience.
Okay. In the 1930s, a young guy called Laurie Lee walked out one midsummer morning, that's the title of his book, to go on his first adventure. And he'd never been abroad, but he ended up deciding to walk through Spain, playing his violin to pay his way. And it's a beautiful, short book, full of all the exuberance and excitement of your first ever adventure. And it's set on the backdrop of beautiful Spain. So ever since I read that book, I've loved it. I've read it regularly, and it's really inspired me in many ways to do journeys of my own and also the style of journeys of my own. So I've always thought I'd love to go do that trip myself, but I can't play the violin or any other musical instrument. And actually, the idea of playing music in public is one of my big phobias, I suppose. You know, I hate karaoke. I hate dancing. I haven't been to a nightclub in many a year. I hate all those sort of public displays of musicalness. So I always thought, it's a shame I can't do that trip. So that's one part of the story. The other part is that I spent the better part of 20 years trying to do big, tough physical adventures that I mentioned, cycling around the world, crossing oceans, things like that. But I started to notice that, and I did those because I wanted excitement and risk and surprise and the fear of failure and adventure. But I started to notice that if you do the same sort of thing over and over again, you get good at it and you lose some of that surprise. And actually, these big adventures were starting to become my own comfort zone, my rut and my routine. And so I decided I needed to start looking differently at what adventure meant to me these days, which eventually, through some wranglings of the mind, ultimately led to me deciding to buy a violin, learn for a few months and then set off to walk for a month through Spain with no money and only my terrible violin skills to pay the way.
You had no musical training up to this point, or did you have some?
When I was a kid, when I was probably eight or nine, my mum forced me to play the piano for a while at school. But I quit as soon as I could, and I hated it. So that did mean that I could read the notes on a music scale. Pretty much I was starting from zero, pretty much. I had 7 months to get ready for this, and 7 months of violin practice really is not enough to make as much progress as I imagined it would.
Yeah, right. What was it like to just make that decision to do this?
Well, I think that there are various stages of the decision. So there's the coming up with the crazy, exciting idea. Hey, wouldn't it be cool to do this? Which is, you know, I'm constantly doing that. Like, wow, that'd be great. I'd love to be an astronaut. Woo! And I get really excited and start Googling. And then I go have a cup of tea and then forget the idea. So there's that fun, excited stage. Then there's the crucial stage of me actually emailing a violin teacher saying, hey, I've had this stupid idea. Can you give me a lesson? And that felt, you know, such a small little thing to do, but that felt like a critical moment of commitment, really. Once I turn up at this lady's house, then you're kind of on your way then. So there's that stage of beginning. And then as the trip actually approached, I started to get very, very nervous because I was so bad at the violin. And the prospect of having to publicly perform if I was going to eat, I found, it was just ridiculous. So I got very scared before that beginning as well. And then when I eventually persuaded myself just to toughen up and go to Spain, there was the final beginning of waking up that morning in Spain. Well, actually, I had a totally sleepless night and walking out into this village square to play my violin for the first time. So there are lots of phases of beginnings, and I find each one difficult in its own way.
Okay. Could we maybe break down the kind of the rules of this experience? So you didn't have any money with you. You didn't have a credit card, you shut off the apps on your phones. What were the rules of the game, if you like?
So I did all those things because I wanted to. Firstly, I didn't want to be on the internet. I just wanted a month away from the internet, which is a totally different topic, but was one that seemed a good opportunity to have that detox. I didn't want any contact with people, so saying, hey, come stay with me in this place, which I've often had on my other journeys and has always been wonderful. This time I wanted to do it completely off my own back, completely by myself, and with no support mechanism of any money. So the first I had money to get myself out to Spain, obviously, but the first morning there, and I stayed in an Airbnb the first night. And then that morning when the trip began, I walked down to the seashore where Laurie Lee began his trip. I emptied out the final coins of my pocket onto a park bench and left them there. And then I walked off. And then for the next month, I had nothing. And it was all down to me somehow making it to Madrid, 500 miles of hiking away through begging, borrowing, stealing, or ridiculously becoming a professional violinist, which just seemed like such a crazy idea. I find a problem with talking on podcasts like this is everyone assumes when a musician says, oh, I'm very bad, they're usually being modest, but I really did sound like a six-year-old screeching away in his bedroom. It was daunting.
Yeah, and what was it like, that first busking experience? Like when you got into that town square and, you know, what did it feel like?
Well, I kept procrastinating for a few hours until I ran out of excuses. And then it was a mixture of, I think one thing I've got good at over lots of years of doing adventures is not taking myself very seriously and doing my best to remove myself from a situation so that I can see it from the outside. So I was able to look at this from the outside and see that this was a hilarious thing that I was doing, you know, I was about to play the violin and everyone was going to get a heck of a shock because it was going to sound bad. So I was able to find the experience very amusing, but also inside my stomach was churning as a kid, if you're worried you're going to get asked up on stage in assembly to sing to the school or something. It was that kind of terror of performance. And also the thinking of, oh man, I've committed a month to this and suddenly realizing no one's going to give me any money. This is a failed plan. I've really bitten off more than I could chew this time. So I was quite cross at myself for having come up with what seemed like a really dumb idea at the time.
Well, and I guess it's very brave, right? Because, well, I think it's very brave because you could, you know, rely on a whole range of things that, well, I'm Al Humphreys, the great adventurer, and you could have bailed at any time, or you could have called upon your following on the internet to you know, follow you. I don't know. You could have done any number of things, obviously, at that moment, but you just kind of stripped yourself of all of that, and it's just, here's Al Humphreys, the novice violinist. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was an exercise in willful vulnerability, really. And it was really trying to get the same feelings that I used to get from, say, canoeing down a scary river or hiking over a big mountain, trying to get that adventurous feeling in a different kind of way. And yeah, there were lots of ways that I could have got out of this. And I was aware, you know, on the first morning I met these illegal immigrant guys, African guys who were trying to sell sun hats down on the seafront to get cash. And they were all looking around and cagey because they knew if the police came along, they had to run because otherwise they'd get arrested and chucked in jail or booted out of the country. And so they were properly hustling for their life. So I was very conscious that I was just playing a game here. I was pretending to be poor. I was pretending to be vulnerable. But I think that's actually reflects how a lot of things we do in life are a lot of the time. You know, when we're scared when we, I don't know, start a new business or something. But what's the worst that will happen? It fails, you look like an idiot, you run out of cash for a bit, and then you'll either get another job or the worst case scenario, the government will give you some money and some food. We're not dying at the things that we're doing in life. And we tend often to be so afraid of committing to trying stuff, whereas through force of circumstance, those guys trying to sell hats, I mean, geez, they are properly living adventurously. I'm sure they didn't want to be, but, you know, that's, I think it's an important thing to bear in mind that most of the things that people like me do are just playing games and pretending, and therefore we should have the confidence just to throw ourselves into it as fully as we dare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, and that's, I guess at some level our minds and bodies don't make that distinction, but when you stop and think about it, most of us in the Western world, all of us in the Western world have access to some type of support that would get us back onto our feet if the worst ever happened. So,
yeah. Now I found, you know, before, I think, when I set off to cycle around the world, which was very much a frightening decision because it was going a different direction to that in which all my peers were going and which my family expected and what society expected. So it seemed like a brave decision to do. But I was conscious when I did it that I had a university degree. I had a teaching qualification. You know, I was not going to starve to death. This was, you know, it was worth having a go. Try this big adventure. Try and write books. Try and do whatever. If it all fails, you'll get, by the end of the week, you'll have a job somewhere. Mm-hmm. You're not going to die. And so I think having that, the safety net gives me the courage or gives me the confidence to take the jump, I think.
That's super interesting. Yeah, it's super interesting on a variety of levels. But one for me is there's very rarely such a thing as putting everything on the line, like those immigrant hat vendors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I think hopefully then should give us all the confidence a little bit to just go for it, be a bit more bolder in whatever change in our life we might be trying to make, just to give it a go. Certainly that's one of the things that Spain trip was trying to do for myself in my own way.
Yeah. What type of planning did you do other than violin? You had, you know, had all sort of a bunch of equipment and things with you, a bivy bag, et cetera. But I guess you're fairly, you know, experienced at that. I guess that the sort of sleeping wild and those kinds of things didn't really faze you at all.
No, and that's one of the points of the whole thing. You know, I had to, we could be having, and I have done for a different type of podcast, a totally different conversation whereby you're asking me what kind of rucksack I mm-hmm. took and why I chose that rucksack mm-hmm. and whether I use hiking boots. And, you know, for some people, walking 500 miles cross country, sleeping rough every night, having to cook on fires would be a really big deal, a real adventure. But I've been doing that for so long that, you know, it for me, packing for that trip would be like you packing to go to your granny's house for the weekend. You just say, I need this, chuck it in a bag, and off I go. So I didn't really give any thought to the actual planning of the hike, the trip, the route, the equipment, and it didn't faze me one bit. And that, again, reinforced the point that I needed to get a different way of living adventurously in my life, because lovely as hiking through Spain is, I know I can do that. So all of my focus and planning and effort and nerves were purely about standing up in a small sunny village square and playing my violin for 10 people, which for a lot of people who can play the violin would not be at all scary. So it's quite interesting the different things that preoccupy us when we're planning big projects.
So you had a repertoire of five songs, was it?
Yeah, five songs that I could play all right. And they reach about 30 seconds long. It was the music syllabus that kids learn at school, grade one music syllabus. So I had the five songs for that. And then I had a B list of a few more songs, which I was really terrible at, but which I could occasionally have a crack at. But it was basically five songs, plus the opening and closing bars to Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road, which I wanted to learn from because I like that song.
What were the sort of looks on people's faces when you could you after doing this for several days? What was the when you got to a new town square and you got the violin out and you had a small audience? What was the initial look after the first few notes started to come out?
I think it was surprise, really. You know, along comes this guy. I don't look Spanish. I was quite dusty from the road. I had a big hiking backpack. So I'm quite an interesting looking guy to turn up in a Spanish village off the tourist trail, get out his violin. It's like, it's quite an interesting thing. A wandering troubadour, a wandering minstrel. And then when I'm just playing like a six-year-old, it's like, what? It was just surprise. A violin sounds pretty bad when it's played badly, so either amusement, a little bit of horror. But to my, I was very worried that people would be unkind to me. That was something that definitely played on my mind. What will people say? Will people tell me to go away? These sort of childish things were bothering me in my 30s, so I was really nervous about what people would think. But although most people ignored me, as they always do with buskers, and some expressed surprise or amusement, basically no one was unkind. Which I think is also interesting. I think we think so often that the whole world is looking at us. You know, for example, if you get on the bus with your t-shirt inside out for some reason in the morning, when you realize you're mortified, everyone's been looking at me, but almost certainly no one's noticed because we're all just busy with our own lives. So it took me a while to realize that no one really cares what I'm doing. Just do my thing. Everyone else is just going shopping in Spain and getting on with their lives.
Yeah, all of us, not all of us, but many of us are just in our own worlds. we think that, as you say, everyone is watching us and making judgments all the time, when in fact probably not paying very much attention.
Yeah, exactly. It's called spotlight syndrome, I learned retrospectively.
We think the spotlight's always on us.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Which is, and once you realize it's not, it's quite liberating. You know, you could walk down the street in with your shirt on inside out and most people won't notice, or certainly no one will care. And I think the same thing then applies to thinking, right, I'm going to start a blog or do a photography website or whatever. It's like, seriously, just no one cares. Just get on and do it. And the whole world's not going to suddenly pour scorn on you if you do something unconventional.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it and dealing with it. What was the kind of, so it was a few euros, what was your biggest windfall, biggest day?
So I had a rule, adding to my rules of making my life miserable, I had a rule that whenever I got money, I had to spend all of that money immediately. Okay. So that by the next town, I would again have no money and be hungry and nervous and vulnerable again. So I didn't want to build up a reserve of cash. So it was quite a feast or famine. So on one day, in the whole month, I earned 120 euros, which was way more money than I thought I would ever earn. I live like an absolute king on 120 euros in a month. But one day I earned 20 euros, which was absolutely wow. Ridiculous. A sunny Sunday morning in quite a, like a touristy town, not foreign tourists, Spanish tourists, but I earned 20 euros. I just couldn't believe it. The cash just kept coming and coming, and I just felt so ridiculously rich. It was just hilarious. So yeah, I went and bought ice cream, and that was an incredible day. And then there were other days when it was a heck of a slog just to earn enough to buy a loaf of bread. So, but I quite like that, the uncertainty this added to the trip.
And what was your typical, I don't know, typical meal, but you ate a lot of bread. And I love the ketchup sachet video that you did.
Yeah, one day I found a ketchup sachet on the road and I was so excited. Free food. So I ate the ketchup sachet I found. Yeah, bread. The first thing I always did when I earned some money was buy a big loaf of fresh bread, which is great. Really nice in Spain and quite filling. And then depending on how much I earned, I'd either have something like carrots or whatever was the cheapest vegetable, and carrot sandwiches, which are pretty disgusting. Or when I did quite well and I got rich, I'd have banana sandwiches. So, and then in the evening, I usually cooked rice. And depending how well I'd done, I'd either have it plain rice or rice with a few tomatoes and carrots, or rice with a tin of tuna if I hit the jackpot.
Did you have any days where you didn't eat?
No, I didn't. I never didn't eat. I had quite a few days when I had to go into half rations, half rations and double miles. If I, for example, sometimes I'd turn up at what I thought would be a town I could play, but it was just a ghost town, or too small to play in. And then I'd just have to speed on many more miles to the next town and cut down my food. But actually, you know, the trip, I earned so much more money than I thought I would. And I'm quite used to frugal living. So that side of the trip was just a delight. The fact that, you know, some people might think, oh, eating banana sandwiches, that sounds terrible. But another way of looking at it is I earned the money to eat a whole banana sandwich by playing my violin. So I just felt delighted at it, really.
One of the passages that I really liked was when you found it, I think, a cherry on the, I don't know if it was on the ground, but and then you the way you describe it, you just, you know, you savored this small tiny fruit, and that was maybe, I think you said, 3 calories or something, 50 meters of walking. But what came through is that, and every description of food and drink, it was almost like you're savoring every, you know, every morsel that you got. And I thought that was super, super interesting. And I was just contrasting it to, you know, I spent £5 on breakfast this morning, for example, and contrasting, you know, listening to your book and that, it just seems like worlds apart.
Yeah, I think I've always enjoyed this I've always enjoyed it from just doing hard physical exercise, is how good food tastes afterwards. Yeah. So appreciating food rather than just gobbling down a £5 breakfast whilst you're scrolling through your phone and barely noticing it, which is what most of us do most of the time. So I love things that make me appreciate small things. And then also on this trip, the money factor thrown in, the frugality, learning to be grateful for anything. So yeah, finding a cherry on the road, and rather than just, as I might do at home now, grab 5 cherries and shove them in my mouth in one go without really thinking. There, I could just polish it and see how beautiful it was and look at the shape and the shine and anticipate the taste. The same thing happened. A lady gave me a peach one day, and firstly, there was that huge gratitude that someone had been kind to a stranger, kind to me, but also then just the ludicrously delicious taste of a fresh peach on a hot day in Spain. I think just all it's a great thing of just forcing your life to be simple for a while, is remembering to be grateful. So then of course, I come back to my normal life and I'm determined to be grateful. And you manage it for about a day or two and then quickly then revert to just opening the fridge and shoving whatever I can find into my face without even really paying any attention to it. So, yeah, it's a good thing, good experience to travel that.
Yeah, it's hard to do that in our day-to-day lives because food is just, yeah, it's always there and it's just, you know, it's fuel and you just assume it's always there. And when it, you know, when it's not immediate, then when there's some scarcity, there's some value in scarcity, isn't there?
Yeah, one thing I've started to do this year is just purely, I think I'm just generally quite masochistic, is I decided to just give up having breakfast because I've always thought that I need breakfast every day. And I've always been someone who said, oh, I can't give up breakfast. I definitely need that. So I just thought, oh, I'm going to give it up. So I've now got this rule to myself that I don't eat until noon every day. So that means right now, speaking to you, I'm actually quite hungry, but I'm doing it because I enjoy that feeling of thinking, oh, I'm really hungry, and having to anticipate it and then appreciate it more. So just a bit of deliberate daily suffering leads to some more appreciation, I think.
Yeah, I love it. Could we talk a little bit about some of the interactions that you had? I mean, you mentioned the hat vendors. One of the ones that also struck me was the ones that you had with people who were immigrants in Spain.
Mm.
And yeah, that would be great if you could just talk a little bit about some of those interactions that you found memorable.
Yeah, I found walking through Spain a more sad experience than I'd anticipated. Mm. You know, the economic crash of the last decade has hit every country, but it really, really has hammered Spain more than I'd realized. And what that meant was that often the towns and villages were like ghost towns. Anyone young, anyone of working age has left because there's no work. They've gone to Madrid or often to overseas to find work. And it really felt empty a lot of the times. And then the other side of it, in the towns, there are, like everywhere across Europe, there are a lot of immigrants. And a lot from places like Romania, but then in Spain there are a lot from places like the Dominican Republic, and there are the same issues, the pros and cons and resentment and necessities of immigrants as we're facing here in Britain with Brexit at the moment. So it was an interesting but sort of exaggerated version of that conversation. And I found I enjoyed talking, particularly to the Dominicans. I can't speak Romanian, but speaking to the Dominicans, because I felt, albeit briefly, an outsider. I was an outsider in their country, in Spain, struggling to earn money, struggling to get by, very much on the margins of society. You know, for example, I'd see people in an ice cream parlor and all I could do was look through the window because I knew that I couldn't afford ice cream. So I felt on the margins and therefore a bit more of a connection with immigrants than I might do normally. And what struck me with them was often just their work ethic and their enthusiasm and their sense of opportunity and gratitude and their thinking that I've come from far off to this foreign land to make the best of things for myself and my family. And I really admired their optimism and their determination. And they were quite a good reminder for me whenever I started to be moaning and feeling a bit sorry for myself that I chose to do this. I'm one of the lucky ones. All of this I've done, it's by choice. I found that quite a good way to reset when I was feeling down and feeling sorry for myself.
This is maybe a fair or not fair question, but what types of people were the kindest, I guess? that maybe were more generous with your violin case, or I don't know, friendly, or can you make a generalization like that?
Yeah, it's always a hazardous you're starting to get into dangerous politically correct ground generalizing types, but you definitely can stand up and busk for a month and you can start to notice generalization patterns. And they were pretty much that youngish people, by which I mean 30s and under, pretty much ignored me and pretty much were either talking to their friends or on their phone and just didn't really notice me. people, the older people got, the more likely they were to notice me and to engage with me. And perhaps that's because they're just old and don't have much to do all day, or it's because they're just from a different mindset of paying more attention to things and they're not checking their Instagram. So my greatest donors were usually people aged about 60-ish, men more than women, but they often didn't want to stop for a chat. They were a bit sort of gruff in their kindness. They'd just toss me a coin and on they'd go. So I'd say 60-year-old men on their own were usually my best bets for giving me a coin. But couples, older people were usually the kindest in terms of giving me money. Younger people, though, when they did give money, usually gave more. So old people was quite often a sprinkling of copper coins, whereas a younger person, if they did notice me and engage with me, would often give the height of a whole euro, which was a decadent for me.
I want to maybe go back to just connect a couple of things that you mentioned at the outset. You said that you thought actually it's a very small minority of adults who have a kind of a sense of genuine curiosity, or one that's pervasive, and I suppose that also that came through in your journey, that how many people actually sat down and had a chat with you and asked you, well, you know, who's this guy, what are you all about, why are you doing this, how many times did that actually happen?
Well I think the caveat to this answer is there's always a risk. There is a definite risk of if you approach some guy who's clearly a foreigner and a bit dirty because he hasn't had a shower for a few weeks. So if you see some foreigner who hasn't had a shower, who's playing a violin really badly, how many of us would walk up to that person and engage in conversation? Yes. We're getting in the realms of a crazy person here who, and also approaching a busker, it's very hard to approach them and then escape without giving money. So it's quite a commitment to approach this person. Mm. So having said that, the best conversation usually came when I wasn't playing, when I was either setting up the violin or just sitting down having a rest, or when I was out hiking. And during those times, I had lots of interesting conversations with people who were curious about who I was because I was off the tourist trail, what I was doing because I looked like I was hiking a long way and I was quite dirty, why I had a violin strapped to the back. So quite a few interesting conversations. Mm-hmm. And then it would get a bit further on to talking about Laurie Lee and his walk through Spain. And to my surprise, no one had heard of him in Spain at all. I don't think his book had made any impact there whatsoever. But it was, a lot of the trips I do are quite solitary affairs. Mm. And this was a very solitary journey, but it completely depended upon me interacting with people sufficiently so that they would give money for my beautiful violin playing. So it was actually in many ways the most social trip that I've ever done. And I very much enjoyed, by nature I'm quite shy, and I very much enjoyed forcing myself to have to put myself out there and have conversations. And my Spanish was pretty good by the end, so I also was quite thrilled to be able to do the whole trip in Spanish in a natural way to people in Spanish. So I really, really enjoyed that side of things. And I'm actually much better at having random conversations with people in foreign countries. Perhaps that is because I've become myself more curious when I'm overseas. Yeah, I think at home I'm sometimes guilty of thinking, oh, that person in the cafe is just a person in a cafe. That's not very interesting. Whereas in another country, I think, oh, look, that's an exotic person working in a cafe. I'd be much more interested to talk to them. So I'm always more curious when I'm in other countries.
That's so interesting. I found that at various points in my life that when you go to a different country, and especially if you're learning another language, that you'll interact with different types of people than you normally would in your home country.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm a total, I love taking taxis around Britain because the taxi drivers are almost never normal British people, so to speak. And I always like it when I get into the taxi and the guy's got some strange foreign accent. And almost immediately I say to them, where are you from originally? And then love talking away about their original country and their life. I'm far, far more curious about that than getting in if it's some traditional London cabbie, and then I just end up talking about football.
Yeah, I suppose because you can recognize the patterns of, we do the patterns of probably what this person, it's perhaps still terrible. I feel a little terrible saying it, but people think that they're sort of in traditional senses, perhaps it's the same sort of pattern of, they do this, so they're like, they're a supporter of Arsenal or whatever. You could kind of know the kind of patterns. Whereas if it's somebody sort of totally new, you're like, well, I don't know where this interaction could go. It's interesting.
Yeah, very much so. I sense your awkwardness in saying that, because there's so much these days about stereotyping people or putting anyone in any kind of boxes. And I love being in somewhere like Spain, where I'm a total random person. I don't know these people at all. They don't know me. I will never meet them again. To just launch immediately into, who are you? Tell me your story. What's your life? And I like that sort of freshness and the unshackled freedom you get from just being a stranger in a strange place where nobody knows you, nobody knows your story, you'll never see them ever again. I just find that blank slate to just start a conversation really, really refreshing.
And I think we need more of that, because actually, with social media and everything, like, well, the Facebooks and Googles of the world, we like to think that everybody's sort of kind of unique, but they've nailed it in terms of what people are likely to enjoy and targeting ads and things like this, because we give them all of this data. And what you're talking about is the complete opposite of that.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I wanted to turn off my phone for a month was that, well, for all the, I mean, geez, I don't need to articulate those reasons. The reasons why we probably all need to turn off our phones for a month, but one of them is that Twitter, for example, which I spend a lot of time on, pretty much everyone on Twitter says things like I do and believes the same things that I do. And if they don't believe the things I do, then they're clearly an idiot and I unfollow them, so that I'm only people like me around. And it's the wonderful thing of going on any sort of journey that forces you into randomness, is that you then just meet the full range of life. And I think that's one thing that I've always enjoyed from my journeys, not the wilderness ones, but the ones amongst people, is just this forcing myself to just be out into the complete random strata of the world. And you need, if you're thirsty, you'll knock on anyone's house for water, whether that might be rich people, poor people, Muslims, Christians, whatever. It's just a human who you want to talk to because you want them to fill up your water bottle. And no one in the world ever says no when you ask them to fill up their water bottle. And I think that's a really refreshing side of travel.
Yeah, I guess conversely, how often did you feel lonely?
Well, there's a very fine line between loneliness and solitude, and they often ebb and flow in amongst each other. And a lot of my journeys, I felt very lonely. So cycling around the world was often a 4-year overwhelming struggle against loneliness. But this Spain trip was just such a joyful experience. It was one of the happiest months of my whole life. I just absolutely loved the experience. So there was the odd time when I was cold or no one had given me any money, or I was quite hungry, when I'd feel a bit sorry for myself. But by and large, it was an experience of solitude, not loneliness.
Did you tell your wife and kids give them updates and things like this on a periodic basis?
Yeah, that was my only breaking of the rule of no communication, was that I kept in touch with my family by WhatsApp. So, which mostly involved me just sending the odd update saying, hello, I'm fine. And then my daughter replying with about 8,000 emojis. So that was pretty much how we, how we communicated.
Yeah, the emoji is an emerging language. I did want to talk about this thing of family and your adventurous life versus the compulsion or your sense of duty to having a normal life and being a father and things along those lines. And I think a lot of my listeners can relate to that, to this sort of pull between wanting to do something that's kind of out there and adventurous and explores the unknown versus, well, having, you know, certainly family obligations, but also perhaps some pressures to conform or to do what's expected of them. And I think you did a lovely job of balancing that with this adventure. And I suppose just some, just asking you for some thoughts around that, you know, having these sorts of things that you want to do as an adventurer, versus, you know, also living and wanting to live for other people that you love.
Yeah, this has been the one of the great struggles of my adult life, really, is the glorious, wonderful, reckless, exhilarating selfishness of being out on the open road. I spent 4 years cycling around the world, which is just such a thrilling, liberating, and utterly selfish experience for 4 years. One thing I noticed in those 4 years, though, was how much I missed community and family and belonging. So then I come back home and I get all that community, family, and belonging. And then I think, geez, this is boring. What I really want is to be out on an adventure again, living this reckless life filled with ambition, trying to push myself as hard as I can. So I go off on an adventure and the cycle continues. So I've been bouncing back and forth between those two things for many years. And then the big change for me came when I had kids and suddenly I couldn't go off for 4 years anymore. But also a part of me didn't want to go off. So then came this quite a few years of just this huge struggle between the duty of raising children versus the incredible tedium of raising children for someone who's spent so long deliberately trying to live really exuberant and dangerous and exciting and ambitious and driven life. And I really struggled with that conflict, and I felt very, very guilty about it, and I felt it was very much a point of shame, really, that I wasn't as delighted a father as society deemed that I ought to be, and yet at the same time I knew that I was the most delighted father that there has ever been, as most dads think that they are, which is a good thing. And so I found this conflict really, really difficult. And one thing that the Spain trip was trying to do, my kids had got to an age whereby they weren't too fussed if I went away for 4 weeks anymore, so it became a viable prospect after quite a few years of not going on big trips. One thing I wanted to do on this trip was to try and, one was to figure my own head out, to come to a point of acceptance that my days of cycling around the world for years on end are over, and rather than moaning about that, I should be grateful for all that I did and try to be excited about new ways of having adventures. For example, playing violin. So trying to not be sad for all that I don't have, but to be grateful for what I did and to be excited about what I might become. So that was one part of the Spain trip, was trying to figure my own head out. And the other part was, now my kids were at an age where they understand what I'm doing, was to kind of show them that, look, this is your dad. He's a bit of a weirdo, but this is what he believes is an important way to live a life, to live life that is wild and bold and curious. They were the three things I kept coming around to thinking, I really want to show my kids to be wild and bold and curious, but I can't just sit at home and tell them that. I need to actually get out and show them. And I'm quite sure they will grow up and have no desire to go play their violin through Spain. But I hope that the fact that I once did that will encourage them to think what their own version of that might be in whatever direction their lives go.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That I think when you, those first two words, wild and bold, the I guess the natural inclinations, we're very linear thinking, a very linear thinking species, right? So wild and bold means, well, okay, you know, you cycled around the world, and then the North Pole expeditions, and you know, all of those kinds of things. So it has to be bigger, it has to be farther, it has to be longer. Whereas actually, maybe we can think of this in a non-linear kind of a way.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Trying to think And this was, I think, the recurring theme of the book overall was, what does living adventurously mean? And I've actually started, since I got home, I started a new email newsletter called Living Adventurously, which is all about trying to live adventurously. And it's nothing at all to do with buying a tent and sleeping on top of a mountain. It's how we express that in whatever realm of life we move in, whether, you know, business or artistic or creative. All of these aspects, I feel now, are potential ways that I can live adventurously. So I think that was a part of this trip, this realization that I can take my life in lots of different directions. It's not a replica of the youth that I had. That has gone, but they're not necessarily worse either.
That's so cool. And we need to talk a little bit about micro adventures as well.
Well, micro adventures is a big whole topic in itself. Yeah. So Micro Adventures was a book I wrote a few years ago, and it was my attempt to show people that you don't need to cycle around the world to have an adventure, and that you can find wilderness and outdoors and nature and challenge and risk and fun close to where you are. Short, local, cheap, simple escapes, even if you live in the middle of a big city, perhaps especially if you live in the middle of a big city. So for quite a few years now, my adventure life has not been big stuff, crossing deserts. It's been micro adventures, so wild swimming and sleeping on hills. Mm. And I think the mindset of micro adventures, of trying to seek out the opportunities for adventure rather than bemoaning the fact that you haven't got £50,000 to go climb Mount Everest, also link into all the other things we've been talking about choosing ways that you can live adventurously within the constraints and frameworks of your busy real life.
How much of that do you think is also the being internally versus externally motivated? So being motivated for, you know, your own values versus, you know, having, you know, going for, as you say, like the, you know, Mount Everest expedition and having a photograph at the whatever at the summit, or that, you know, those kinds of being able to brag to your mates about what you've done.
Yeah, I think my own journey through this was, I began adventures partly for my own curiosity, mm-hmm. and purpose, but also very much so that I could show off to people and prove myself and try and be extraordinary for the first time in my life. So there's very much a degree of look how cool I am when I started adventures. And then I guess as time goes on, you grow up a bit, and I kind of pushed that. Well, that got superseded by wanting to prove to myself X, Y, and Z. And then after a few more years, I kind of felt I'd done that as well. So then that then got me to a point whereby I was no longer trying to prove anything by having adventures. It was just something that felt important to me. And therefore, I'll just go climb a tree in my garden or sleep on a hill and not fret too much that someone doesn't think that's as exciting as climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah. Okay. That's a really cool description of your journey. For some of my listeners who might feel like they're a bit, I don't know, stuck or wanting to get a little bit of that taste of what you did in Spain, what do you tend to say when people ask you these kinds of questions? Like, how can I live more adventurously? How could I take some steps in that direction?
Well, they should sign up for my Living Adventurously newsletter, because it's exactly all about the idea of dreaming up a big idea, which not many of us struggle with. You know, we all have the dreams, but I actually have this written just above my desk here. I have four words: dream, commit, begin, stretch. I think dreaming up a big idea is easy. Committing to doing something is harder, and then beginning it's the hardest part of all. But one thing that microadventures has shown me is that the best way to get started on something big is by starting something really, really small. So if you have an idea to do whatever it is, something massive, then try to find the tiniest manifestation of that and go do it this weekend. And if you still feel too stuck, then the idea is still too big. So make it even smaller and smaller and smaller until you do something. Do something small. Realize that, hey, I've done it. That wasn't too bad. I also enjoyed it. then by next weekend, you can do something a tiny bit bigger. And through this, you start to overcome inertia and you start to build up some momentum, build up some self-confidence. And micro adventures have been brilliant for that, for lots of people. People who want to go on big conventional adventures, but get so bogged down and thinking, oh, I need £10,000 and I need a Gore-Tex jacket and all this stuff. And yet by just going out this weekend and climbing a hill they'd never climbed before, that sets them going on the route towards momentum and actually making the big stuff happen. Mm-hmm. So go climb a tree. That's a general solution to most of my problems in life these days. Climb a tree or swim in a river.
Do you, what types of things scare you?
The things that scare me are getting old and regretting not having made the most of my potential and my opportunities. That is my number. That pretty much is the nub of everything that scares me. Mm. Yeah, I can say that pretty concisely because I'm pretty clear on that.
Mm-hmm. And that's super interesting as well, because I think a lot of folks, myself included, the types of things that would scare them would be, you know, losing the things I've got, getting sick, or, you know, these kinds of things.
When rowing across the Atlantic Ocean is an interesting experience because in prospect it sounds terrifying. It's, oh, what if there's a tornado? What if we capsize? What if we get eaten by a shark? So there's all these things you can be really scared about. But the reality of every day is you just sit on a boat and you row, and as long as you keep your harness clipped on and as long as you keep the hatches shut, then whatever storm happens, you're not going to sink. You basically can't sink. You can't fall off the boat because you're tied on. The wind and the current eventually will blow you across the Atlantic, even if you just sit there eating cheese all day. So you can't fail. So there's a massive difference between perceived risk and actual danger. And I think a really useful thing about doing lots of travel and expeditions is realizing that what things you have no control of whatsoever, and therefore you should just put them out of your mind and just trust yourself to deal with them as best you can if they happen, and then actually spend usual mental bandwidth worrying about the stuff that you do have some control over and which you can influence. And I think those big travels have been very helpful for me in trying to take that approach to my daily life. So yeah, I might get, you know, until you said that, I've literally never, this has never crossed my mind, but I might get lung disease, heart attack, cancer, and that would be really bad, but it literally never crosses my mind on a daily level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super. That's also wonderful advice. And what do you do when things go wrong? When something's happened that you didn't anticipate and kind of sucks?
Well, I just cry, laugh, think, what on earth am I doing? Get a bit angry. And then the good thing about doing solo trips is then there's literally nothing else to do except take a deep breath and go about trying to fix it or come up with a new plan or deal with it in some way. And I really enjoy the simplicity, not the easiness, but the simplicity of trips whereby it's just down to you to solve this problem or to acknowledge that the problem can't be solved and therefore I now have to go a different direction. And realizing that, you know, if you set off on a big adventure and nothing goes wrong, that doesn't mean that you're amazing and some sort of genius superstar. It actually means that your adventure was too easy and too small and that you're being a bit of a wimp. So if you're going to do anything big and interesting in life, stuff will go wrong. And if it doesn't, what you're doing is too easy. So I just try to think, oh, this sucks. Of course it does. And then get on and fix it. Yeah, and the same. I don't worry about things in advance. I just try and deal with them when they happen. And then the other thing that's useful is to remember back to other times in your life when things have gone wrong. And generally, in the end, things figure themselves out, and that bad thing turns into a useful anecdote, either for a dinner party or for writing a book.
That's wonderful. And all this stuff, like it when you describe it, I can sense that it comes from, you know, a deep sense of experience.
Yeah, but you know, my natural inclination as I mentioned earlier, is of someone who would worry a lot and be nervous and take and wail and howl when things go wrong. But yeah, I've just deliberately tried to make myself live a life that pushes myself into places that make me uncomfortable. And the nice thing about that is that you eventually get to a point where you start to feel much more comfortable about life and yourself. So I'm glad that I've taken those things. I think it's made me chill out and not take anything too seriously.
Yeah, I think that's super important, and also tough to do, but super important to do. I want to be conscious of time, of your time, and respectful of your time. Think we should probably wrap up soon, but actually I had two things. One is, for my listeners who don't know you and want to either pick up a copy of My Midsummer Morning or follow you or all of that good stuff, where are the best places to do that?
Well, my name's Alistair Humphreys, and that should help you find me on Google, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Amazon, all those sort of things. I've got two different email newsletters. The normal one called Shouting From My Shed, which is sort of anecdotes and interesting stuff and books from the world of adventure. And then my new one, Living Adventurously, which is kind of more about the sort of stuff we've been talking about today.
And you work from your shed, right? Or you?
Yeah. So I my micro adventures book was my greatest hit book, and it was so successful that I could spend all of the money from it on a shed. Not quite a Ferrari, but yeah. So I have a shed in my garden. So I'm speaking to you now, and it's full of maps and books and mess, and I love it. And it's my great place for just coming to get on and try and write books. And then when I leave the shed and I go back to the house, then I try to be a good dad. Mm-hmm. But it's a very good separation of the two halves of my life. Although having said that, I do have in front of me a post-it note saying zip wire, which is because I'm planning to build a very big, dangerous zip wire for my children. So that's a crossover of work and home life.
Wow. Yeah. It must be, you must be excited about the prospect of, or just the journey that your children would go on, because, I'm sure you're a super fun dad.
I try to be, and I'm getting better. As I've got more accepting and less impatient, and I think I'm doing all right now. I do all the sort of school runs and pickups and stuff, so I've my 6 hours of work life a day, and then the rest is dad life. But it's thrilling to see their adventures unfold. It's heartbreaking when they have their little disasters, but I think watching their adventurous life unfold is way trumps going on a big bike ride of my own. So it's a good thing to do.
Awesome. And so the final thing I just curious about is whether or not you've got your violin out in front of you, and if you could play us a few notes of the Muppet Show theme or Guantanamo.
I'm very sorry. It's over in the house, not in my shed. Sorry.
No problem.
I'll spare your listeners that.
Oh no. I might actually include a little 10-second clip.
There are lots on YouTube. Yeah. So feel free to put any of those on to wake up all your listeners who've fallen asleep by now.
Have you continued playing it?
I continued for a few months to do my grade one exam, which was a terrifying experience in all sorts of ways. And then I pretty much retired. It sounds terrible to play the violin, and it'll take me so many years before it sounds nice. So no, I've pretty much quit, sadly. Okay.
All right, no problem. The kind of final thing was, and this is, I'm sorry, this is a terrible question because you've talked about it in the book. It's, what's the next adventure?
The next adventure is, I don't know, actually. I'm currently quite busy with writing. So I'm writing a kid's book at the moment. And I actually, for the first time in my life, don't have a huge to-do list of adventures. I think, which is weird, for over 20 years, I could have rattled off to you 20 adventures I was ready to go do. And I'm actually not too sure at the moment, which I sort of feel is perhaps a good sign. Maybe I'm growing up.
I think so. And I'm sure something will grab you that's kind of unconventional and that, you know, kind of fits within your, the way you've, you know, built your life at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, at some point I need an idea to write a new book. So, but yeah, I haven't had the idea yet, I'm afraid.
Okay. All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground. Was there anything that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to go over?
No, it was good. Thank you. You asked good questions. I enjoyed it.
It's a huge pleasure. I'm honored that you were able to spend a bit of time speaking to me and my listeners. So thank you very, very much for this.
Thank you for having me.
All right. If you enjoyed that as much as I did, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy of Alistair's book, My Midsummer Morning. It's a beautiful, incredibly vibrant book that I'm sure will inspire you. And of course, find out more about Alistair by checking out all the links in the show notes. And before we go, a further reminder that our mini course, How to Set Up Any Decision for Success, is live and available for free. Check out the link that is also in the show notes. We will be back very soon. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.